you in the mood for gardening? I know I am. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to talk about your garden and maybe how you can help heal your environment around your garden. Our guest today, Ben Fuda. He is the executive director of the Allen Centennial Garden right here on the UW-Madison campus. He's going to update us on what's going on in the Centennial Garden this spring and give us some ideas for plants and gardening practices that are good for your garden and the environment as well. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a garden photo, post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And you can post a question there as well. And Lexi Brode, our on-air producer today, will be happy to help me out with that and forward it along. And Ben Fuda, great to have you with us again. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And, you know, Allen Centennial Garden, most people are familiar with it, but just it's a wonderful place to visit and right on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus.
It is. So it's a stone's throw from the Lakeshore Path and just a little shorter stone's throw from Babcock Dairy Store. So it can complete your campus experience, get an ice cream, enjoy the garden, and then walk it off down the preserve. So
yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, the garden is open year-round. It's, of course, free, and the gates never close, so you're welcome to visit anytime. Weekends really are the best. Of course, parking is free and a little easier to get onto campus at that time, but people are welcome anytime.
Yeah, actually, there's and paid parking right across the street, mm-hmm. actually, and in a ramp parking, so that's pretty cool too. What's the purpose of the garden?
So we like to call ourselves an artful living laboratory, an outdoor classroom, of course. So we're used, for teaching UW students in horticulture and landscape architecture and many other disciplines. But of course, we are a model for home gardeners as well to demonstrate. We have a number of different garden styles and garden types, everything from our rock garden, which is really coming into season right now. Our woodland garden also is looking tremendous. But we have a number of perennials on display. We have a number of wonderful woody specimens that are great for smaller garden spaces. The garden itself is only 2.5 acres, so we have a postage stamp to work with. So we really try to choose only the best.
Yeah, and it is really a wonderful experience just to visit it. And since my office isn't that far, I have a chance to stop in pretty often. So I really enjoy going over there and visiting. And you know, one of our topic areas was environmental gardening and. How do you practice that at Allen Centennial Gardens?
So I like to say that we demonstrate exceptional and sustainable ornamental horticulture. And really, I think everyone, we sort of shy away from this idea of having an explicit pollinator garden, for example, or an explicit water-wise garden, because we feel that every one of our spaces should support pollinators in some way, and every one of them should be, ecologically friendly and water-wise, for example. We try to take that a bit one step further by looking at this concept of ecological gardening, which is sort of marrying these two disciplines of horticulture and ecology. So ecology really looks at seeing systems in our world. So rather than maybe looking at, just trying to solve the problem right in front of us, we maybe step back and really look at what's happening here. A great example of that in the Allen Centennial Garden is our biofilter. So this is an installation that helps us purify the water in our pond. It's beautiful year-round, allows us to showcase some great aquatic plants, but it's also a great nursery space for frogs and toads, which right now they're singing, and mm-hmm. it's a wonderful thing to hear. But we also have a number of hostas in the garden, and public enemy number one of hostas is slugs. And so, sort of anecdotally speaking, over the last couple of years, once we've introduced this new biofilter feature, we're encouraging this, amphibious wildlife into the garden. You can't turn over a leaf or a stone or anything and not find a little toad there. But we've had zero slug damage in the last couple of years, not one bite. I have to think that to some degree that is due to us encouraging and sort of welcoming these beneficial organisms into the garden environment.
That is really, really cool. And some of your favorite plants from the environmental garden?
Oh, where to start? The biofilter, again, is specifically is just some great aquatic plants. But in terms of just sort of strong performers, I really like to look for plants that not only look good when they're in flower, but also look good sort of post-flowering in their seed head stage. Also, those seed heads are great support for birds and other wildlife and other insect life. Echinaceas are really wonderful in the fall. The finches just devour them, and it's a wonderful thing to see. But any other... really, native plants in general are tremendous for, of course, our local pollinators. The butterfly weeds and the Asclepias family, all of them are really tremendous performers. Anything with a taproot.
Well, I tell you what, Nina on Facebook says that after she heard you speak on the Garden Expo or at the Garden Expo, you inspired her to put in an asparagus hedge.
Oh, excellent.
In her front yard. And she's posted a picture. Let's see if I can find the photo on our Facebook page. Is that it?
That looks like Virginia bluebells, I think.
No, that's somebody. That's another post from somebody else. We'll get to that in a minute. Maybe I can find it. Oh, of course, I can't find it right now, but we'll find it in a minute. So, an asparagus hedge.
Yeah. So this, I'm so thrilled, Nina. Please send me an email because I'm obsessed with this idea. This idea is inspired from Chanticleer, which is a wonderful public garden on the East Coast, and they planted this asparagus hedge sort of as a wonderful backdrop to their cutting garden. But another layer of this sort of ecological gardening is looking at, oh, there it is. Oh, that will be beautiful. it's fresh, but it'll be awesome when it's up. So this idea of sort of incorporating food plants into an ornamental setting as well. As an example of this is we just planted some currant bushes in a slightly shaded area just as sort of some foundation plantings. You know, we could have chosen something that was strictly ornamental, but we chose the currants because, of course, later in the year we can harvest them, but we're growing them in an ornamental way, but also they're feeding us. And the asparagus hedge is a concept that works much the same. We get those sort of ornamental characteristics, but we get to eat it at the same time, which is great for us.
Well, I'm glad she posted that photo. Looks like it's going to be a cool...
It does. I love the curve. That should be fun.
Yeah, that looks really nice. If you don't have to be a member of Facebook, by the way, to go and look, but go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. And look under... it's not under visitor posts. It's right under the sort of the promotional picture we have for today's show, and that looks like it's going to be pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
Really good. You can join in, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That's the title of our page. And I think what we had here from Jennifer. Jennifer wonders, what's this plant?
So that is Mertensia virginica, Virginia bluebells. It's a wonderful naturalizing spring wildflower. It'll, as the picture shows, it comes up very early and very quickly in spring. It will just be covered in these sort of wonderful lavender purple clustered bell-shaped flowers, and then will sort of melt away by July and will just disappear until next spring.
And Jennifer just moved into this home, so they
perfect
didn't know about the plant.
It's a wonderful plant. I will caution, it does not move well. Once they're established, it's very difficult to transplant an established clump. If she's looking to maybe move them around or make more, I would do that as the plant is going dormant later in the summer, and then just keep it well watered once it's been moved.
All right, there we go. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Well, you've talked about some things. You're getting toads and so forth in there that are maybe taking care of the slugs. What other types of, or maybe besides the water, what other kinds of things can we do to help the environment as we garden?
So something that every gardener is sort of confronted with weeds at some point in their life, pretty frequently, and of course, a lot of our discussion is around, well, how do we make gardens more maintenance friendly, more lower maintenance, and my answer is always plant more plants, which, ground cover is really the way to go in terms of if any light reaches a soil surface, that's where we'll have weeds. And weeds really play an important role in our landscape in that they heal damaged earth. Nature sees this exposed soil as a bad thing. And really, most of our conventional mulches are very foreign to a lot of our perennial plants. So, for example, any of these, again, things like echinaceas, for example, that we grow, they're native to prairies. And they never came from... You know, they never grew in an area where they had 2 inches of bark mulch around them every season, for example. Bark mulch is very foreign to a lot of plants. So what we do is plant fairly dense plant communities, plants that touch, you know, things mm-hmm. that mingle. And then in the spring, we go in and we just take a regular push mower, set it on its highest setting, run over it a few times. We bust up that plant material and leave it right in place. Makes our lives a lot easier. We don't have to haul away, you know, so much compost. We don't have to haul nutrients back to the site later. And it over the course of a season, it helps to suppress weeds in the spring. It'll decompose over the course of the summer. And it's just a much more... It takes 20 minutes to cut down a garden rather than an hour and a half, which is pretty nice.
Oh, that's wonderful. Jerry in New Franklin has something for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's New Franken, like Frankenstein.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. I got lilacs and the honeysuckle, and it's kind of unkept a little bit. You know, we kind of just got in this place, and there's a lot of shoots coming out from where the lilac is and the honeysuckle. You know, it's real knotty, and, you know, there's new growth, but, you know, it's not thriving as well as I think it probably could be. And I'm just wondering, best time to prune, or what should I do, or propagating, or what? Basically, prune.
Sure. So it sounds like there may be some renewal pruning that needs to happen to sort of reinvigorate these plants a bit. For any of these sort of multi-branching, multi-stem, clump-forming shrubs, sort of the rule of thumb is to take out no more than 30% or so, 20 to 30% of the canes in any given year. Best time to prune is actually probably either late summer, fall, knowing that lilacs in particular bloom on second year wood. So by pruning later in the season, you may be removing a few flowers for the coming year, but you'll want to look for the biggest, oldest branches in there. Leave sort of the younger, more spry ones and try and take out those bigger, sort of older, knottier ones. And then that will encourage new growth to come through. And it's probably a good, just sort of best practice to do this maybe every other year, I would say. Every year may be ambitious, but every other year we'll just keep those young shoots coming up. And those are going to be the most floriferous and put on the best flower shows for you going forward.
Okay. So let the young shoots go. You're saying.
Yeah, you want to get rid of the big ones because mm-hmm. they're the ones that are not going to flower for you.
Okay, and same with the honeysuckle. It's a little different than the lilac. You know, it's kind of wrapped around a post, but you know, you can see them where the main trunk is, and that really doesn't have much new shoot type deal. It's just does that main trunk kind of have to stay there? I would imagine, huh? Or no?
And is this a vining variety?
Right.
Yeah, in that case, I would leave the main trunk, and for any of those, in this case, it's almost the reverse. These sort of smaller, more wispy, tendrily pieces, those are going to be the ones that are less likely to flower in the long term. So pruning them back, and you could do this now for the honeysuckle, pruning it back to maybe 3 to 4 buds away from that sort of those main big anchor stems that are probably, you know, at least the size of maybe your thumb in width, or cutting back to sort of that size. And cutting back to those buds will help to rejuvenate the growth, and those sort of spurs, as they're called, will be places that will help to generate better flowering. You may not get better flowering this year, but as you continue to prune for the next couple of years, it should encourage flowering.
Okay, right. Thanks so much.
Yeah,
sure thing.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joan on Facebook is looking for a native ground cover for a sunny spot in her yard. Do you have suggestions for native ground covers? For sunny spot.
That's interesting.
Often people are looking
for
shade.
Yeah. depending on...
Depends a little on the slope of the area, I would think. And
The first thing that's coming to mind are a lot of native grasses. Some of the lower growing species and varieties A lot of carex, the sedges, are grass-like but are very adaptable to sunnier and shadier conditions. Carex Blue Zinger, for example, is a wonderfully adaptive cultivar. Has sort of a nice steely blue tint to it. It's great in shade. It works great in sun force as well. If you're working with a really, really hot and dry area that maybe drains well, the sedges probably aren't your best choice. Those might be great if it's a slightly heavier soil. For the really hot and dry conditions, even if it's a little gravelly, I would almost look to some of the grasses, like the prairie drop seed, maybe the little blue stem. They're a bit taller than, you know, maybe conventional ground covers. People are looking for 6 inches or so. These may be more in the range of, you know, 18 to 24 inches, but they certainly will colonize well and sort of, you know, over time form a nice blanket over the ground.
Talking today with Ben Fuda, Executive Director at the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Brote, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, we'll be taking a close look at native plants for the Midwest. I hope you can be with us for that. Right now, talking about keeping your garden environmentally friendly and all the different kinds of plants and ways you can landscape to make it environmentally friendly with our guest, Ben Fuda, from the Allen Centennial Garden. Let's go to Marion in Concord next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I would just like to encourage people to join the National Wildlife Federation and establish a certified wildlife habitat in part of their yard. We did the backyard of ours, and you just need to supply food, water, cover, and places to raise young. So we have a dead tree, which is for woodpeckers and for perching. And I went to Goodwill, and I got a lot of glassware that we hung upside down, and it's quite decorative, and everyone seems to like it. But you don't have to cut the grass, and you see rabbits, and you see squirrels, and it's good for the environment. So you get a sign so that, you know, you can post on the edge of your certified wildlife habitat that says that you are indeed part of the National Wildlife Federation.
Very cool.
Perfect.
Ben, are you familiar with that program?
Vaguely, but I can say I think this is a great thing to do. I think it helps to, again, sort of formalize a little bit what you're doing. And also, again, I think she mentioned there's some signage, again, that they might send you, or just some basically awareness building where if you're, especially in maybe an urban or suburban setting, it can help your neighbors understand sort of what's going on and the value that this community brings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Neil in Cottage Grove, your turn next. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Okay, I'm going to have a new garden, and I found this morning that this thing is growing over with a lot of Creeping Charlie.
Yeah.
Can I use Roundup on it without affecting my garden if I don't till it for a couple of weeks?
Roundup is a tricky thing. I'm not versed well enough in terms of how long it will take for that fully to break down. I mean, Roundup should take care of the Creeping Charlie if you... I mean, now would be the time to hit it because it's in an active state of growth. It will help to take it out quickly, depending on... It sounds like you may be working with a larger area. So if it's a smaller area, removing the Creeping Charlie by hand is your more organic way to go. But also recognizing there are times when sometimes we have to break out the chemical warfare for, you know, taking on something like Creeping Charlie for sure.
But if you look on the labels of no matter what chemical you're using, it'll give you a time. And I think it is around 2 weeks is just sort of my memory, but I check any label for their recommendations. Should be all right, but check the label on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Neil. Bill in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Had two questions. One is about trumpet vines.
Okay.
I'm thinking of putting in or planting some trumpet vines, and I'm just wondering if that's a bad idea. Or I've read something suggesting it'll take over the neighborhood, and I just wanted to... get your thoughts on just how prolific they can be and if there's any mitigation I can do just to keep it in one spot. And then second question is about pawpaw trees.
Okay, let's take the first one first.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the vine, yes, they can be pretty prolific. they are wonderful for hummingbirds, butterflies. I mean, they are a great sort of nectar source for a lot of those species.
That's why we want to plant them.
Definitely. If you're, depending on where you're doing it, if it's in a more, I would say, sort of confined setting, so if it's in your backyard, if it's in a bed that's maybe more, it doesn't spread by runners, so that's the good news, but it can reseed.
Okay.
I am not intimately familiar with all the varieties that are out there, but there may be some newer cultivars that perhaps are sterile. I know there are varieties. If you're going with a very straight native, however, then if there is a chance it will reseed, but as far as I know, it's not considered a aggressive plant, but I would just double check that with the DNR, maybe, but I think you're probably okay.
Can I just gather up the pods?
You could, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Second question is pawpaw trees.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about putting in a pair of pawpaw trees, and I've been running into some mixed information as I hunt around on the internet. How much shade, it's sort of a conflict on how much shade they should have when they grow, and whether it's best to do pot grown.
So the in terms of sun exposure, the when I've seen them in their natural habitat, they are acting really as an understory tree. I mean, they're very definitely filtered shade, heavily filtered shade. However, that being said, plants can be pretty adaptable. And I know at Olbrich here in Madison, Olbrich Botanical Gardens, they have some pawpaws that, while they have some, you know, maybe afternoon shade, they're in some more direct sun, maybe, you know, earlier in middle of the day.
Right.
And they seem to be doing very well. So, you know, I think I would maybe stay away from doing full-blown direct sun. But, again, if there's an area where it may get partial sun for the day, I don't think that will harm it, for sure.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for calling. Someone wondered about the upside-down glassware that our earlier caller was talking about that she hangs, and she's probably still listening. If you're listening, if you have a photo of that, you could post just to see how that looks in a garden. Mm-hmm. We'd love to see that. So if you have a photo, you could post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to see it. Diane in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. We have a pagoda dogwood that we planted last year. And on the branches, not on the leaves, there are spots, lightish, whitish spots. And I was wondering if that's something to be concerned about or if that's just how they
common
grow or what.
It sounds like those are probably most likely lichens, and it's nothing to worry about is the good news. It's a sort of symbiotic relationship that the tree has, and again, it's... If it could also potentially be a type of scale, not having a photo of it, I'm not really sure. The scale, however, you would know as the tree begins to leaf out. If the leaves look a little distorted or stressed, then chances are it's something maybe to be more concerned about. But if the leaves look healthy, if it flowers well this spring, most likely it's a lichen and nothing to worry about.
It looked kind of like a lichen. That's why I was questioning it. But I will watch as it grows. The leaves. Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Diane. And Scott in Prairie du Chien. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually had two questions. The first one was kind of going back to lilacs. We have a lilac tree in our backyard, and I know you said, I might lose flowering, but it's an old growth lilac with kind of three main trunks, and they're getting old and they're kind of slowly falling over. And we like the lilac. We want to keep it. I'm thinking about just cutting them off one trunk each year, and I'm assuming will it sprout back and give me flowers the following year then? That's my first question. The second question is about greenhouses. I've been reading on greenhouse, possibly doing one for the wintertime, and I'm reading where people are recessing their greenhouses into the ground a ways, or especially on a south-facing side hill,
yep,
and using that sun or heat to keep everything going during the winter. I'm wondering if that, I assume you have to add another heat source as well, but I'm wondering if that a realistic expectation for, you know, the Prairie du Chien area to be able to grow vegetables with shorter day lengths than that kind of a greenhouse setting.
So for the lilac, taking that one first, I think you're on the right track there with, again, sort of taking up maybe one of those big old canes first. If it doesn't have any younger sprouts coming up, doing that first one in the first year, waiting to see if anything happens in the first growing season, because if it doesn't start to put up new shoots, there are instances I've seen where sometimes if there's very, very old lilacs, there's a chance they may just be hitting their life expectancy, and they won't regenerate. But again, taking off one of those three canes, it's going to be most likely to rejuvenate. If it doesn't begin to come back and you really like this variety and want to keep it, then I'd recommend maybe taking some cuttings from the good growth and just repropagating that and starting a new plant. And again, this is only if it's a very, very old selection, but that renewal pruning should be the way to go. I would start there and see. In terms of the greenhouse, I haven't had personal experience, but I know I'm familiar with what you're describing, sort of using the soil and you know, maybe bricks or something to sort of retain heat throughout the day. It would definitely need some degree of supplemental heat in the winter. I've seen, depending on how organic you want to go or how sort of off the grid you want to go with this, I've seen instances where they sort of pack the floor with, say, fresh manure and hay, and sort of the heat of that decomposing helps to keep the greenhouse warm over winter, and then you just remove it in spring and can apply it, maybe not right away to the garden, but can be used then in the outdoor gardens. But you're probably going to be able to do, like you mentioned, day length as well. Probably mostly things like greens, short season, cool season veggies. Probably wouldn't be able to get away with tomatoes and something like that. But yeah. It should work. Again, I've never done it personally, but I have seen it happen, and it seems doable.
All right.
Okay. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. And Rich and Nina... Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just want to comment on my experience with trumpet vine. And I've at my own house, I had it by my garage on a trellis, a nice little plant. And then before I knew it, it took over the whole side of the garage, coming up under the siding and out the windows. And it was a horrible mess that took several years to get rid of because little pieces of root would be left behind, and so it definitely can spread by runners. And what I did is I took a piece and moved it by a telephone pole, so now the problem is controlled, so I can mow around it, and I still have the plant, and it can't do any further damage. So I just wanted to
make that comment. Sure, thank you.
Yeah, caution your listeners about where they put the thing.
Yeah, siding plants is a big part of right plant, right place, for sure.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thanks, Rich. Thanks for giving us your experiences with that. You can join in, too, by the way. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Pam in Hartford next. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just have a question on using preen for weed control. I recently heard someone say that you should remove all the mulch in your beds, put the preen down, and then put all the mulch back on. And it just seems so labor intensive. Is that really the best way to go, or can I just increase the percentage that I use if I don't remove my mulch?
Are you working, is this a like an edible garden or just like a perennial ornamental space?
No, just perennial, yeah, shrubs. Mm-hmm.
So my recommendation is to, for me personally, speaking to ecological gardening, to completely avoid the preen in the first place. So my sort of approach is to essentially plant more plants. So any place that light is reaching the soil surface is where you're going to have any kind of weed problems. So the more sort of densely plants can come together, sort of form strong plant communities, that'll mm-hmm. really, really help to suppress weeds, make your life as a gardener a little bit easier. And if you do, mulching is still the best way to go if you do want, you know, have some areas where maybe plants can't fit. But I would use something like a leaf compost or leaf mulch. The bark mulch is a really sort of foreign thing to a lot of plants that the soil microbiology really doesn't know how to handle. The plants don't know how to handle. But they are used to sort of growing in, you know, past seasons growth and, again, decomposing leaves. They decompose quickly. They improve the soil sort of texture. And so those would be my two thoughts. But the preen, again, it's also sort of a short-term moment where it's, you know, applying it every year and the runoff effects and things are things I'd like to try and avoid if we can.
Okay, so when you say leaf compost, that's what you recommend over bark.
Yes. Yep. In place of bark mulch, that leaf litter is a great substitute.
Okay. And I mean, are you talking inches like they use? Like I would use bark.
So if you're using sort of the distressed leaves, so something again, if you have a yard with leaves, you can just put a bag on your lawnmower, and that's really the easiest, cheapest way to do it. Sometimes you can get it from cities and municipalities when they pick up in the fall as well. But typically, the leaf mulch has a lot more air in it than bark mulch does, just because of how sort of fluffed up it is when it goes down. And so you can usually apply it between at least 2 to 3 inches, but it should decompose. Almost within a season, it'll sort of reduce itself down to, you know, maybe half an inch to an inch deep, if that. And by next spring, you will need to apply it more frequently, but it is more beneficial, more friendly to sort of the soil and the plants around them.
Okay. Very interesting.
All right.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kathleen on Facebook says she loves blue grama or eyelash grass for tidy ground cover and dry, sunny places. She says it's complementary to any plant. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I think that one would work really well. I believe that is native as well, if I'm remembering. Going off the common name, I believe she's referring to a native. And so, like I said, grasses for those sunny, dry spots are really probably your best option for ground cover options.
And let's see, Glennis in Port Washington is wondering if you can speak to the influx of jumping worms at Olbrich Gardens.
I can't speak for them explicitly. I can say that we also have them at the Allen Centennial Garden. I think it's unfortunately an inevitability of gardening in this area. And with any sort of new pest or foreign agent, we're sort of learning as we go, really, to realize what they're doing, the impact they have, how they're affecting our gardens, how to control them. You know, we haven't found a natural predator yet. We haven't found, of course, digging them by hand is just really not...
Can't do it.
In the areas where we have them, I can say, you know, and I'm sure Olbrich is doing similar things, we're still sort of in the wait-and-see phase a little bit to see how they affect a lot of our plants. The areas that are sort of badly infested with them, we have one in particular, sort of a little corner that last year was pretty rough. And we noticed that some of the shallower rooted plants, we had some wonderful sedges in that area, and you just sort of barely graze, you know, nudge them with your hand and they just sort of fall out of the soil. They seem to sort of, the jumping worms change the texture of the soil, and unfortunately those sedges didn't seem to tolerate it very well. But we also had some native nodding allium in the space, and those were anchored in like those weren't going anywhere. And so, like all pests, they... alliums and things in the allium family aren't very desirable. You know, of course, this is all anecdotal to us still, but it seems that certain plants are becoming are more adaptable to this infestation than others. I know it's not a very comforting thing to say, but what we really are trying to do is mitigate the spread. So making sure our garden tools are very clean, making sure our shoes and boots are cleaned off if we're in an area where we know jumping worms are in particular, trying to be very conscious about not sharing plant material whenever we can help it. And that would apply to home gardeners as well. So it's a tricky situation, but still just sort of watch and learn at this point a little bit.
Yeah, and I know there was at least one plant sale that was canceled.
Yes, the Wisconsin Hardy Plant Society postponed theirs this year, just to, in this the same mentality, just to sort of wait and see.
and see what happens, and not wanting to spread to other areas. Let's go to Tom in Brookfield next. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, good morning, fellas. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Good. I have a question for both of you, and you rarely hear about it, but I used it last year on my vegetables, and that was worm castings. And I could not believe the results, and I'm not going to plant any vegetables anymore without using worm casting. What is your take on that?
Typically, any animal poop is good for vegetables. It's sort of decomposed horse manure, chicken manure, any of those sort of wonderful organic fertilizers are pretty wonderful for especially growing those really nutrient-needy plants like vegetables and annual flowering plants. I don't personally have any opposition to it. I think, again, it's a wonderful thing, of course, utilizing good healthy worms, but it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, because I buy a 50-pound bag from a lady that actually owns the factory in Caledonia, and I used almost the whole 50-pound bag. She says, "Well, plant, put a handful or two in when you put the plant in," and then she says every couple of weeks put a little top dressing on, and man, I couldn't believe the difference.
I believe it.
And
pardon me?
I believe it. Yeah, that sounds good.
And she says you can't use too much of it because it won't burn out your plant.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. Well, and so worm castings. Thank you.
Worm casting, yes, because it looks just like topsoil. There's no odor to it. Nothing. It just it looks like really really fine ground up dirt.
Appreciate that advice, Tom. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks.
Yeah. Appreciate the call. We got an email from Jeff, who has posted on email a photo of a weed invading his school's nature center, and wondering if you can ID it, Ben, and if so, how do you get it out of a native landscape?
It's not ringing any bells. It looks similar to some things, but I'm not 100% what it might be. Mm-hmm. I would maybe check in with the DNR, see if, especially if it's in a native environment, they might have some thoughts on best management practices. Typically, it varies depending on the plant, whether digging or selective herbicide application is the best. But since it sounds like this is a school area, we probably want to stay away from chemicals of any kind. If depending on how much there is of it, a shovel is maybe the best way to start, but also ensuring that we keep as much ground cover on the soil as possible. So old leaves, sticks, twigs, again, sort of insulating that soil from fresh germinating seeds will help a lot to control things that spread aggressively by seed.
Let's go to Tim in Eau Claire next. Tim, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, vague memories that I'm working with here, so you got to forgive me. But as a child, my dad used to take us out hunting for night crawlers, and he would do something where he electrified the ground, and all the worms would come right to the surface. I don't know anything about these jumping worms you guys were talking about, but I'm wondering if that might also draw them to the surface so they could just be picked up.
I love the creativity of this. I will also say I've been looking into... I hesitated to say this earlier just because I thought, this might sound a little crazy, but... there's a technique called worm grunting, which is essentially a piece of 2x4 and sort of a large piece of iron metal that you stick the 2x4 in the ground and sort of run this piece of metal over it, and the vibrations mimic the sound that a mole makes when it's hunting for worms. And so the worms hear this, they freak out, they think they're being pursued by a hunter, and they all sort of pop to the surface. And it's the same quality, to catch worms for fishing and other things like that. And I really want to test this on jumping worms. And see if, I haven't done it yet. I just saw it a couple weeks ago. But, people who were in the room with me when I saw this did not understand why I was so excited about worm grunting. But it's something we want to try and see if it works. But that I think some of these creative solutions may – I don't know that they'll eradicate the worms, but I think they could help us control them and keep them in check.
I think it was my grandfather who made one of those electrified he took a broom handle or something and then had a metal rod attached to it somehow, and then you plugged it into electricity and you had to have the ground had to be a little wet.
Mm-hmm.
And the night crawlers and worms would just pop up to the surface.
Interesting.
But it seemed kind of always, I always thought it was kind of a dangerous operation to be fooling around with.
Mm-hmm.
But he made his own. He made his own, Tim.
Yeah, I think we used a couple coat hangers and I can't remember if he had AC or DC voltage, but if DC voltage would work, I mean, you could use a little garden tractor battery and mm-hmm. be all set.
It could be where, I guess, where the dry, why not? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Oh, thanks a lot for calling. There's probably other people who can remember that or maybe even using those kinds of things today. I was always a little worried about getting electrocuted myself. So before we go back to the phones, I've got to remind you that we are talking environmental gardening today. Our guest, Ben Fuda, executive director at the Allen Centennial Garden. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Ben Fuda, executive director of the Allen Centennial Garden. Questions, I hope you'll join in. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And go to our Facebook page right now if you can, because there's a cool photo of a young bird that is riding on the side of someone's car and actually flies in and sits on his shoulder. It's pretty cool.
In downtown Chicago.
In downtown Chicago. Yeah, it's a pretty cool video for sure. Ben, you've got a big event coming up May 6th.
We do.
Tell us about it. It's a family day, isn't it?
It is. So this is our annual family gardening day. And so this is when the garden and many other sort of green entities and in our little pocket of campus, including the D.C. Smith Greenhouse, the Steenbach Library, the Master Gardener Program, and many others come together with our friends organization to put on a number of free family activities for throughout the morning. So the full details are on our website, and there's also a Facebook page for that as well, UW Family Gardening Day. But many, many hands-on activities, things you can make and take home. In the garden, for example, we'll be making shiitake mushroom logs that people can take home. All tools and everything provided, while supplies last. We'll be doing some sunflower planting for kids. We'll be giving away what we call pasta packs. So one of our staff this morning said, who needs Olive Garden when you can bring home a pasta pack? And so kids can take those home and plant their own little pasta gardens. And we'll have, and those are just a few of the highlights. So we'll have many excellent things, but again, free and open to the public on May 6th.
May 6th at the garden. Again, you've got parking right across the street.
And it's free on weekends, so it's perfect. Absolutely.
Yeah, free on weekends. Kathy in Winona, Minnesota, we turn to you next. Hi, Kathy.
Hey there. Hey, I have a question about, and I know you've had this before, about newspaper as far as mulch.
Yep. Not a problem. Shouldn't.
Okay. Should I strip it out, like in little individual, you know, cut it up or what?
Depends how ambitious you want to be.
I don't want to be ambitious.
So you can just lay it down in its full sheets. Because it's so thin, it will break down pretty quickly over the course of the year.
And it's not going to affect anything.
It should, no, most newspapers are using soy-based inks now, so they should decompose and shouldn't be toxic. I would stay away from using any of course, those sort of glossier inserts they may do, but if it's sort of that pure, nice, matte newspaper, it should be good. You might need to weigh it down with either a little bit of soil or a little bit of leaf compost or something, but just to keep it from blowing away. But otherwise, it should work great.
Hey, I've got another comment just on the night crawlers.
Sure.
Go out with a pencil with your cottage cheese empty container and just pick them up and stick them in there.
There you go.
I do that when it's after it's rained.
You use a pencil. You don't grab them with your fingers.
No, I use a pencil because otherwise you squish them.
Well, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Kathy's a fisherman, or a fisherwoman, a person who fishes.
There you go.
That way. Terry and Nina, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have two questions. Ben, do you have an opinion between the fertilizer that is sold in the big box home stores under their store name as opposed to the brand name Scott's? Question number two is my neighbor says that he has wonderful results on his grass with Milorganite. What is the makeup, and do you have any knowledge about that product?
So I don't, unfortunately, know. I think Milorganite, I want to say, is human?
Yes, it is.
Human-related rather than livestock-related waste. Again, I really any waste just solid is a pretty good treatment for really any fertilizer, and I would lean in those natural fertilizer directions before going to something like Scott's personally. My go-to is decomposed horse manure. I sort of use it as a top dressing every few years, spread it on maybe half an inch to an inch thick around perennials, shrubs, that maybe need a little boost. And over the course of the year, the rain sort of percolates the nutrients down very gently. It enriches and improves the soil, but I don't put it on too heavily. You also mentioned lawns. I can say we contract out with a wonderful company here in Madison, Bando Organics, and they treat our lawns with a compost tea mixture that it works very well on lawns. Our lawns are beautiful, and again, that's an organic way that we go about doing that.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thanks for calling, Terry. Appreciate it. Is there a difference between a big name fertilizer and then the store fertilizer?
It depends on the brands you're looking at, probably. Again, for myself, I like to try and stay away from those as much as possible, just because the production process, the environmental impact of producing those fertilizers is so tremendous. But just in terms of air quality, water quality, and then, of course, no matter how careful we are, there's always a risk of having runoff, which could, you know, affect our waterways and our other natural areas. So really using those natural fertilizers like decomposed manures, composts, things like that are sort of my preferences.
Let's go to Ron in La Crosse now. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I heard this one caller ask about preen, and I know your guest is rather critical of using it because it's, synthetic pre-emergent. But there is an organic pre-emergent called, it's corn gluten meal.
Yep.
And it's supposedly, you don't have to worry about any chemicals being put in your garden. And I till my garden, I got all the existing roots out from previous growing season, and I put down some preen and I raked it in, and I also added organic potting mix, but normally you put it in a pot, but I use it in my garden. And I put some composted soil that the city of La Crosse makes, and then I covered it with plastic, not the permeable stuff, but the after it's got a quarter inch of water, you water in with a quarter inch rain, you cover it with plastic. You know, the same type of plastic trash liners are made of to keep any rain or anything, because any more than a quarter inch of precipitation might encourage the weed seeds to germinate. And I'm hoping for the best. So,
you used
corn gluten meal, I think.
Corn gluten meal.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
I my last garden I was at, we haven't used any here. We did use it there, and it was... It certainly is not as effective as the full blown chemical version, but it does do a little something. It's better than nothing, but it doesn't necessarily. There may still be a few weeds that come through, but it is a better alternative than, again, going the chemical way.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to respond to several previous callers. The first one was the man who called in about building a greenhouse.
Yeah.
My husband built an addition on our garage, and he built a greenhouse across the south side of it, across the addition and half of the original garage. And it's a design that he ran across in an old, years ago, Mother Earth News. And I think they have a comprehensive collection of back issues online, so you probably could find it. The idea is that in a greenhouse, you only need glazing on the south side. and you insulate, you make solid the east, west, and north sides and insulate it. So it's built against the garage and is insulated. And we put a, now I don't know if this would work if you were building this out, just out in your yard somewhere, but we put, I mentioned yesterday that we put a 3,000-gallon cistern, rainwater cistern, under the floor of the greenhouse. Well, in that cistern, we have 180 feet of copper tubing, and in the cement floor over the cistern, we have another, I don't know how many feet, lots of, many hundreds of feet of plastic tubing embedded in the cement. And an old, the greenhouse, will heat up to 90 degrees. As soon as the sun comes out, the greenhouse will be 90 degrees in a flash, almost, I mean, virtually instantly. And so we have a coolant or a liquid that circulates through that tubing, goes up through an old car radiator that an old by the roof of the greenhouse. And we have an old furnace fan that blows the hot air through the car radiator. It picks up the coolant, picks up the heat, takes it down, and dumps it in the cistern.
This sounds like an amazing process. Stella talked about it again, and here we are running a little bit out of time right now. It sounds fantastic, Stella. I wish you could take a photo and put it up on our Facebook page. I'd love to see it. Ben Fuda with us here on the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here and my guest, Ben Fuda. Ben is the executive director of the Allen Centennial Garden, directs the operations of the garden and its programs. He has a background in landscape architecture and sustainability. You may have some gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And let's, we have open lines. We get you on really quickly. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Karen emailed to say that she has in her flower bed bindweed. It's loaded with bindweed. She wants to start over with a native garden, wondering how she can get rid of the bindweed before doing this. Also wondering what she should do to eradicate the asparagus beetle.
Well, I can say for the bindweed, this is one of the nastiest ones that we've got out there from an aggressive weed standpoint. This is one of those instances where I think we have to almost bring out the big guns, chemicals. Roundup sometimes works. It may take a couple of applications to really knock it out. Bindweed is very durable and resistant. It can't really be dug out because it spreads by rhizomes that are very deep below the surface, usually break off any time you try to pull them out. And you'd just be fighting it forever. So, again, unfortunately, chemical warfare, I think, is the way to go with taking on bindweed. In terms of the asparagus beetle, I haven't had much exposure with that, but I would maybe direct you to the plant disease diagnostic folks here on campus, and UW Plant Disease Clinic. I think they've just set up a Facebook page as well, so I'm assuming you could sort of connect with them there and they can give you some tips.
We had a few people calling in with stories about someone getting electrocuted in their town after electrifying jumping worms. And so my caution was, I guess, a good caution. You want to be...
Use caution, yes.
Very careful. I guess I wouldn't do it. Deb on Facebook has been spreading mulch the last couple of summers trying to dig out lamb's ear from her garden. Actually, she hasn't been mulching. She's just been spending a whole lot of time trying to get rid of it. Is there a more effective way to fight lamb's ear?
If it's the... if by lamb's ear she's referring to just, again, those sort of grayish, soft, fuzzy leaves, really digging, I think, is the best way to go. I haven't seen it be too terribly aggressive. It should have fairly shallow roots. It sort of spreads by sort of these horizontal stems. Have really should pull out fairly easily. You know, if she could maybe post a photo or something, if we can get a better idea on the plant, because true lambsier should not be too aggressive in terms of it might reseed certain older varieties, but it still shouldn't be too thuggish.
All right, so post a photo up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll see if we've if what you have is really lamb's ear. We can look into that. And again, you can call us at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you once again. And I want to go back before we go back to the phones here and talk about that May 6th event.
Sure.
Maybe give us a little more detail on that.
Sure. So this event has been rolling for several years now, and again is a great opportunity for families to experience not only the Allen Centennial Garden and sort of bring out kids who may be interested in gardening, or hopefully we can get them a little give them a little touch of the green thumb. But it's a great way to sort of see behind the scenes of a few things that happen here at UW. So for example, you know, working families, I think, can create little terrariums in the DC Smith greenhouse, which is a wonderful, always open to the public, but this is a really great time to come see and experience that. The one of our most popular features is the insect encounters, insect ambassadors, you know, having letting a stick insect or hissing cockroach crawl up your arm. You know, it's some kids are really into it. Others shy away a little, but it's still a wonderful sort of hands-on experience.
So there's lots to see and do. It's May 6th. How long does it run? It's what, like all day, or what is it?
I believe it starts at 10 and rolls till 1, but double-check our website just for the final details.
Jan in Wisconsin Rapids up next. Let's go there. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. Wonderful program.
Thank you.
I am wondering if I should leave a combination of maple leaves and pine needles on my hosta gardens, or should I rake it off in the spring? Now, this, if you want to call it mulch, is from last fall, and normally I do rake it off, but it's such a big job, and perhaps the plants are getting some nutrients. I don't know.
Yeah.
It depends on the quantity of pine needles, I would say. If it's only sort of a dusting in there with the maple leaves, I would actually say leave them. I think over time it will help to build the soil quality and should be pretty beneficial to the hostas. But if it's maybe in a spot where, you know, it's at least an inch or more of sort of compacted pine needles over the winter, I would probably take those off just because that sort of quantity can really impact the soil pH over time, and could, again, it's not going to happen overnight, but if it's a heavy amount of pine needles, I would probably remove them.
Yeah, I would say it's a good half inch to an inch thick.
Yeah, if it's verging on that inch, I would probably still rake those out in that
okay.
case.
Okay. Well, you answered my question.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Sorry to make more work for you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And you don't have to rake it all off. Just get most of it off if you can. That's the main thing. We have an email, or I'm sorry, on Facebook, Linda sent us a note. She says, I'm pulling garlic mustard today in the Crestwood School Forest Restoration Project. Bloodroot, hepatica, Dutchman breeches, twin leaf are all blooming. Here's my question. We have an infestation of jewelweed. It came in a disturbed area and is now growing just about everywhere. I know it's native. Is there anything we can do?
I will confess I'm not really familiar with jewelweed, actually. Depending on what it is, I mean, certainly pulling it might be the first route to go. But again, not being familiar with it, I don't know the best method of control. But in her comment, she did mention, of course, it was in a disturbed area. So any of those moments of disturbance can really, you know, sort of make it challenging to do restoration. So trying to minimize disturbance certainly will help control the spread of it, I would imagine.
Let's go to Isaiah in Racine next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, what would be the best plant that you would use for, like, your kitchen?
Foyer, so
nice
like
little
a
house plant,
like a little windowsill or something. Something I enjoy. There's a lot of great succulents out there that work really well. Calancho is one that I like. It'll flower pretty nicely, usually in late winter. This time of year, primroses I think are a great window plant. The most supermarkets and garden centers should have them. They're pretty tiny, but a really nice little pop of color.
Okay.
What about herbs?
Herbs should do well this time of year, especially starting herbs to be planted outside later in the year. Basil, parsley, things like that would be great.
Yeah, and they smell great, too.
They do.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks, Isaiah. Appreciate your call. We had something on Facebook from Robert, who sent a photo of his greenhouse in the backyard. He made it from old windows and... I forget what he... I don't see what he's got. Some sort of carbonate for the roof. And looks like a pretty cool operation.
It does, yeah.
Looks like a pretty cool operation. Let's see if we've got another photo of... Oh, that goes back. All right. So there's... If you want to take a look at a greenhouse that somebody else built using old windows, there's your opportunity. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Some gardeners like lots of color and many native plants. A lot of them don't have color, don't have that. What plants do you recommend for gardeners who want the showier plants?
That are native? Plants. There's Rubeckia maxima is one that I think is tragically underused and a really wonderful plant. It's probably 5 to 6 or so feet tall, depending on where it's planted when it blooms. Those traditional sort of wonderful black-eyed Susan type petals, the big, long, yellow petals, a really strong, tall seed head. But the most striking thing about this plant is it has these big, almost tropical sort of silvery blue-gray leaves. And of course, because it's native, it's really well adapted for dry, harsh conditions. The seed heads stand up for a long period into winter, just very stately and wonderful. Also, I really like the Amsonias. Amsonia hubrictii in particular is another wonderful native. Beautiful clusters of big, sort of powdery blue star-shaped flowers in spring. Just goes to sort of a nice green placeholding shrub with very fine leaves, sort of almost like willow-like, but then goes a wonderful, just bright, bright gold in the fall, which is so a really tremendous performer.
So, and the first one again was?
Rubeckia maxima.
Rubeckia maxima.
Mm-hmm.
I know we'll have people, otherwise, if I didn't mention that again, we'd have people calling and say, what was that plant again? Tell me what that plant again? Oh, man. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. And we've got another caller coming up online from Dee, I believe, in Sturtevant. And so let's see if I can get her on the line. Oops. Oh. Get her on the line there. Oh, let me try once more. Dee, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter wants to get married in our yard, and I'm planning on putting an arbor up. What kind of vine could I have that would last well into the beginning of October?
That would be something for a display this year, it sounds like?
Right. Correct.
Is there a color theme you're going for with the wedding?
Well, purple and orange.
Purple and orange. Okay. Let's see. There's an annual vine called Spanish Flag that you can typically buy from seed this time of year. Will grow very quickly as it begins to get warm, but they're just sort of these wonderful clusters of a gradient from sort of pale yellow through orange and a deep red. Hummingbirds love them. Again, they will probably grow 6 to 8 feet in a season. So those should cover the trellis by later in the season. And again, they'll persist through up until a heavy frost. And then something, if you are going for purple with that, hyacinth bean vine is another.
Again,
a hyacinth bean vine.
Oh, hyacinth. Okay.
And again, those have they're in the bean family, so they have sort of those big clusters of deep, deep purple green. Deep purple bean-like flowers. Big again, sort of wonderful leaves, sort of purplish stems. So if planting those two together, if you're going for purple and orange, could be pretty striking for that time of year.
Wow.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Are you trying out some new, a lot of gardeners like to try new things every year. Are there new flowers and plants that you've got in mind for planting an Allen Centennial Garden or something recent that that you've had some success with?
So one thing, we're always experimenting, and honestly, we're in a lot of what we do, we're almost looking backward a lot of the times to sort of find plants that have performed well for a long period of time. We also, you know, are happy to work with a few local nurses in the area that do some really great plant breeding for ornamental plants. Intrinsic Perennial Nursery, Northwind Perennial Farm, both of them do some great strong perennial introductions. One in particular, I don't know if it's from either of them, but it's a Heuchera Autumn Bride is the cultivar. And this has been available for a while, but it's, you know, so many of the Heucheras are almost annuals anymore. There really aren't, the newer introductions are really kind of flimsy, dare I say. But Autumn Bride is wonderfully adaptable. It can take almost full sun to full shade, blooms to huge clusters of nice sort of pearly golden, creamy colored flowers in fall. And it's just, it's evergreen as well, which is a really wonderful characteristic. And also Digitalis grandiflora. So it's a wonderful perennial foxglove, and it's a true perennial, for especially woodland edges, areas with maybe morning sun and afternoon shade. It really likes that sort of marginal line, but from year to year, it'll just sort of keep adding these great clusters of, again, sort of creamy yellow bell-shaped flowers, a little bit shorter than those traditional sort of pink and white foxglove we plant, but it's so much more dependably perennial as a foxglove that I'm really liking that one.
Anything new... Oh, and here I just drew a blank. I'm sorry. With hostas.
Oh, I will confess I am not the hosta expert. I would look to maybe the Hosta Society or something like that for maybe some of things that they're looking to.
Yeah, I'm always kind of on the lookout for a new type or variety or a larger one. Some of the giant hostas. The Flower Factory is one of the places that you can go to in southern Wisconsin that they have some absolutely fantastic hostas that are well, at least a treat for me to see. Jim emailed to say how he can stop the spread of spirea in his yard. He's wondering how... what would be effective for controlling it?
So it sounds like it might be something that's spreading via suckers. So he's maybe trying to rein in the suckers without harming the main plant. Spirea, as far as I know, don't sucker. So I'm wondering if it maybe is something other than spirea. But either way, if it is something that is suckering, spraying those suckers, there's a good chance that it could impact the mother plant. It may not kill the mother plant, but it certainly could stress it out. In this case, mechanical removal is probably your best option. So just getting the shovel out and sort of digging out those smaller volunteers.
And I'm wondering, I'm going back to Alan for a minute, because in the past you guys have used vegetables as in attractive ways in the garden. And talk a little about that.
Yeah, so we... something that we try and do is use edible plants sort of mixed into a lot of our plantings because, you know, of course they're incredibly beneficial because they nurture us, they feed us, they help us stay healthy. And, you know, I think totally cutting them out of an ornamental setting is a real missed opportunity. Again, the asparagus hedge we looked at earlier, we planted a row of currants, in sort of a semi-shade area, but those currants are next to things like hellebores and pulmonarias and epimediums that are just now starting to bloom. And I think it's very possible to create this layered landscape that not only is sort of nurturing to the eyes because it's beautiful, but nurturing nutritionally as well.
And we've got that photo of that asparagus hedge. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you would set something like that up.
Well, from an aesthetic perspective, looking at using it as you would a traditional hedge, so a backdrop for another garden or, you know, maybe a barrier along a certain moment, you know, separating one space from another. But essentially, of course, because it's not a true woody perennial, it will die back and have to regrow every season. So sort of bearing that in mind, based on where you're putting it, if you're looking to create a permanent screen between maybe a neighbor or an unsightly view, this may not be the best option for a year-round display, but it's great for sort of a ephemeral seasonal installation. So that being in mind, essentially you would plant it as you would any typical asparagus, sort of create your trench, you know, lay the roots in the following sort of the planting instructions. And it can take any form. Individual who posted it on the Facebook page, I think, did sort of a curvilinear design. You can do, you know, wonderful just sort of straight, angular, formal lines. But again, it is not only nurturing, but beautiful to look at.
Yeah, it sounds great. And you don't eat those then?
You certainly can. I would harvest them as you would any other asparagus patch and, you know, just sort of let them fern out later in the year as you would in a vegetable garden setting. But they're so elegant when they sort of go into that fern out phase that really playing into that as an ornamental characteristic is a great opportunity.
Sharon recommends the greenhouse in Winter, Wisconsin, for anybody who's looking for hostas.
Excellent.
So there we go to northern Wisconsin. Winter is a favorite spot of mine, and I've done a lot of musky fishing on Lake Winter, as a matter of fact, and caught quite a few. Robert on Facebook posted some great photos of his greenhouse, and we've got we had the earlier one, and here's another one that he's posted. And as you can see, he's got these windows, just old windows that he's used, and looks to me like he's got some rain barrels there.
Yeah, definitely.
And some really large ones. Do you guys use rain barrels?
We do. We have a couple, especially this time of year before our irrigation is turned on. They're very helpful. Of course, it is certainly a slower method of irrigation than plugging in a hose, but it is great to, you know, we sort of use them, of course, as display. We don't really rely on them terribly heavily for this time of year, but you know, if we were transplanting any early spring things, if we're doing any early spring plantings, we will just sort of walk over, fill up a watering can, and go from there.
Wow. And your favorite spot in the Allen Gardens?
Oh God! Right now, there's three spots actually that are really singing. The Woodland Garden with all the spring ephemerals is just it's right at that. It's hitting that wondrous perfect moment. We planted a bulb lawn a couple of years ago in our English garden, and so that is right now just hitting its stride and should be looking good for another couple of weeks. We planted some 5,000 naturalizing bulbs, scillas and daffodils and grape hyacinth in there, and that's wonderful. And then our rock garden as well. So many of those alpine plants are really early spring bloomers. Every daily there are things beginning to pop in there, so it's a great time to visit.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be able to visit with you. Here's some music coming back in. A little music here. And you'll come back and be with us again, Ben. And don't forget, May 6th, the big event on the College of Ag and Life Sciences campus, including the Allen Centennial Garden, Family Garden Day. And you'll have a chance to do all kinds of fun things with your kids or your grandkids there. Ben Fuda is executive director at the Allen Centennial Garden, directs operations of the garden and its program. So it's always great to have him visit with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.